This is the next class in the then and now, which we're working principally with the dual ornament of liberation in either of the two translations. And our focus this evening is on the chapter which Gunter translates as the vicious state of samsara. To review, we started off by looking at an answer to the question, what makes spiritual practice possible? And the answer to that is Buddha nature. What do you need to have in order to be able to develop spiritually? And the answer to that was the precious human birth, or to interpret that in modern language, being sane a sufficient amount of the time in our lives in order to appreciate that there is some work to do. And then how do, where do we find out how to practice? And the answer to that is from a spiritual guide, from a teacher, essentially. And what do you do? And that is to work with instructions. And the first set of instructions that we worked with is the instructions on death and impermanence. And the function of death and impermanence practice is, at least in the early stages of practice, it's primarily motivational. And it is to draw a distinction between what we ordinarily accept as the aim and significance of life. It's being defined by the society and culture in which we find ourselves living. And the fact that actually this experience we call life is ours and ours alone. And it's really up to us to decide what to do with it. The next chapter, where we're going to start now, is on the nature of ordinary experience. And I'd like to begin by posing the question, is all of this teaching on suffering of samsara, and I want to talk about that word suffering for a minute, what is all of this teaching, what question is all of this teaching an answer to? There's something we've looked at before, and I'd like to come back to that. First, I want to talk a little bit about this term suffering. The Sanskrit is dukkha, D-U-K-H-A. The Pali, I believe, is dukkha, which is D-U-K-K-A. And in those languages, it has a very broad range of meanings, covering any everything from anxiety and slight discomfort to extreme physical and mental anguish. We don't really have an English word which has that same range of meaning. And the most common word that is used now is suffering. But a word that I've been experimenting with, and usually with fairly good results, is the notion of struggle. And we've talked about this a bit before. Because if you ask a person in our society, do you suffer? Most people will say no. They don't relate to their experience as suffering. But if you say to them, do you struggle in life? Pretty well everybody says yes to that. So, and there can be little struggles and minor struggles, and then there can be big struggles. And there are all kinds of things we struggle with, things inside ourselves, things outside ourselves, and so forth. So we could also call this the chapter on struggle, the struggle in life. So at this point, what's the question that all of this teaching is an answer to, or this set of instructions or information or perspective? What would you say? I know this wasn't on the assignment. I'm springing this on you completely unprepared, but I know you're up to it. Anybody? Junior.
Why do we practice?
Please. Are they on?
Yep. Why do we practice?
Yeah, how'd you get there?
Well, this chapter gives a description of ordinary existence as struggle, and I think most people would like to find a way to relate to their experience so it was less painful.
Less struggle or less painful? I'm being sticky on words here.
Yes. Less struggle.
Okay. Why do you say less struggle rather than less painful when I raise this as a distinction?
Because after many years of your teaching, I've come to understand practice as changing the way you relate to what arises in experience rather than... It's not an anodyne. It's a different approach.
Okay. We come here to a very important point. This term dukkha, which I've described as having this wide range of meanings. And then, which is often translated into English, or usually translated as suffering, could be translated as discomfort, but that doesn't deal with the more dramatic forms of dukkha. Could be translated as anguish, but that doesn't deal with the lesser forms. I've suggested struggle. There's also other words we have in English, such as pain. What's the difference between pain and dukkha, or suffering or struggle? And what was behind my question, I think Julia was aware of this, pain and pleasure are sensations. Happiness is more, happiness and suffering are states of mind. And we can go a step further and say that there's what arises in experience and how we react to it. And what dukkha is referring to primarily is the way that we react to what arises in experience. And Julius proposed the question that this chapter is an answer to is, why do we practice? And I presume the answer would take something of the form as we practice because we struggle with our experience. Would that be right?
Yes.
And so then the question is it possible to find a way to experience things without struggle, which would be without dukkha and so forth? Okay. Anybody else? Anybody have any other candidates here for the possible question? Everybody happy with that one? Susan.
What will we run up against as we practice?
Oh, you think if we don't practice, we won't run into dukkha, do you?
Well, I was thinking about it, and it seems like the different realms are all, all the different ways we're not awake.
Mm-hmm.
So, if we're on the path to awakening,
mm-hmm.
then that is what we would come up against. That was my thought.
Okay. I'm going to suggest a different wording for the question. You tell me if this fits. How do I actually experience things now? Yeah, because and the reason I'm suggesting that is, it isn't really conditional on our practice. If you follow, so it's not simply what do we run up against in our practice, but what when we start to practice, when we start doing meditation, we find that our way, there's something rather screwed up or distorted or confused or whatever about the way that we experience things. That's actually what we discover in our practice. Okay? Anybody else? Chuck.
It just seems like there's a difference between struggle and suffering. I mean, okay. You can, you know, part of growing up and developing is a struggle, but it isn't necessarily a suffering. Growth is a struggle, but it's not a suffering.
There might be differences of opinion with that, but okay. So your point is?
Well, I just don't think that struggle has to do is a good
okay.
word for suffering.
You think suffering works?
Right.
Okay. All right.
To the point.
Okay. Randy, there's a microphone right behind you.
Thank you. The word I think of when I think of translating dukkha is unsatisfactoriness, which is a relationship between what the experience is and how I'm responding to it. And so for me, the opposite of that, what I'm striving for is satisfactoriness, is an acceptance of, well, here's the experience and here's me, and that's okay.
So what would you say the question here is then? What makes life unsatisfactory?
It's not just unhappiness, because sometimes happinesses can be unsatisfactory too.
Yes, quite often actually.
You know, like they don't last long enough, or
it's not enough.
It's not enough. There's, you know,
yeah.
whatever. There's always a little fly in the ointment there. And so it's more an attitude in relationship with the experience. It's not the experience itself, and it's not me itself. It's the relationship between the two.
Okay. So how would you word that as a question that this chapter is answering?
To be in, or to learn to be in a satisfactory relationship with my experience. That's not very good, but that's the best I can do.
Okay. Given the nature of the material that is described in this chapter, I think it might be more in the direction of what makes life unsatisfactory. Would that sound, because that's what it's describing, is how it's unsatisfactory. Okay. Anybody else? Okay, so we've had several suggestions here, and I think they're all good candidates. There isn't one definitive question, but what's your question? What's the question you find that this answers for you? Monica.
Why do I struggle or suffer?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Anybody else? Because what's very important here, if we're going to work with these teachings, is we have to consider what is the question, the answer for us, and which means what are our own questions. How many of you have the question of what makes my life unsatisfactory, or why do I struggle, or why do I suffer? Does anybody besides Monica have this question on their mind? Okay. So let's take that as where we're starting from. Now, in reading this material over, the assignment I gave is primarily on the six realms, which is what we're going to get to next week, and we had a rather short time on that, so I want you to, over the next week, continue with looking at the six realms, and we'll go into that in much more detail next week. The first thing that Gampopa does is open the chapter up with a question, which is it's implicit, but it's there. So it says, "Okay, if we know we're going to die, why don't we just eat, drink, and be merry?" That's what basically the first sentence is about there. Okay. If we know we're going to die, why don't we just eat, drink, and be merry? So what's your answer to that? Alex? You don't know. Okay. Anybody have an answer to this? Heather?
The only thing that comes to mind is something that it's just not our nature, like to just enjoy, like what she was saying about how we relate to things.
Yeah.
For whatever reason, it's not our nature to just eat, drink, and be merry, relate to him that way.
Just not our nature.
Doesn't seem to be.
Well, I think we've had it kind of conditioned out of us in this culture, perhaps, but there are other cultures which seem to do that. So why don't we just learn to eat, drink, and be merry then? Kara?
Because in our society, you got to have money to eat and you got to have money to drink. And if you don't have money, then it's not very merry.
Well, then leave the society and go live somewhere else.
I can't afford the plane ticket.
Oh, yeah, I mean, let's face it. To afford the plane ticket, put it all together, 2-3 months max, and then you could just be out of this culture.
I just don't think it's And I mean, I think it's a waste of time to just focus on all of those things in life. And I think if you're...
Oh, now you're... This is a totally different thing. Okay, so...
I was kind of kidding. I'm sorry. I mean, but from a logical perspective, we can't eat, drink, and be merry because somebody has to, you know, plow the field. Somebody has to do the laundry. You know, on a basic level, like... The things that make us happy have to be produced by someone. So someone somewhere is not going to eat, drink, and be merry all the time.
Okay. The reason that we can't eat, drink, and be merry is because we don't know when we're going to die.
Right.
Okay. We could be here for a long time. And we have to... take into account the fact we may have to have a place to live for a year or 2 years or, God forbid, 20 years. Mm-hmm. Right. Heather?
I just have a question about that then. Maybe I'm contradicting myself or something, but in the midst of plowing and working and whatever else you have to do to put shelter and, you know, put yourself in shelter and have food, whatever, can't you eat, drink, and be merry in the midst of all that? Like,
okay, so...
I don't know what the answer, it just brought up that question.
Yeah, well, so, I mean, there's some people who live that way. They just live for enjoyment. They do their work, and then they go and live for enjoyment. Is there a problem with this?
Or enjoy the work. Some people would be merry plowing.
Yeah, some people actually like their work. They're a relatively small number, but they're fortunate.
When you brought that up, I thought of, like, all those old Dutch pictures of, like, you know, the drunken villagers and, like, everybody's
Oh, Peter, Bruegel.
Yeah, Bruegel. Yeah. I've seen about Bruegel, yeah.
Yeah.
That's immediately the image that it conjured, and so...
Well, there's also Hogarth, The Rake's Progress. So what's the problem with this? Art. We have one here? Yeah.
It's been my experience that because of life's circumstance and...
I think you need to hold this right. Okay.
Because of life's circumstance and my own nature, the third one is at times strangely elusive.
You've got the eating down, you got the drinking down, but the being merry is a little harder.
Yeah, you know.
What gets in the way?
Oh, people die. You know, what was merry once sort of changes, and then you're not quite sure what's merry next. And, you know, it's just sort of strangely elusive.
Okay. So basically it doesn't work, is what you're saying. And this is something that's very important to realize. I mean, Gunther, in his inimitable way, opens this up with... It is plain hedonism. If you think it does not matter what does, if you think what does it matter that the transitory dies, or why should I make the most of it when I have obtained the most perfect wealth of sensuous and sensual enjoyments among gods and men? In some way, it doesn't work. It doesn't satisfy, right? And now we're right back with the problem that we had. This is not satisfactory. So, the first of the noble truths is the truth of dukkha, the truth of suffering, or if Chuck will allow us, the truth of struggle. and we have this strange situation where here we are, and it's very difficult, it seems, for most of us to experience satisfaction or peace or whatever one wants to call it with our lives as they arise for us. And just eat and drinking works up to a point, but then, as Art was saying, the being merry loses its flavor or whatever. And if you notice people who actually live that way, they grow more and more desperate as their life goes on longer. It's like a party that's gone on too long. So, what the First Noble Truth is an invitation to is to get curious about our experience. And again, I think this is a very, very good way to come to this material. As I've mentioned many times, the Tibetan tradition really presents things, because I mean, this is Buddhism had been in India for anywhere between 1,000 and 1,500 years before it came to Tibet. So this stuff was really thought out, had been churned over and over again, and the Tibetans were Buddhism was a hugely civilizing influence, so much so that the word in Tibet for Buddhist is Nangpa, which means basically insider. And you're civilized if you have an interior life. And they regard anybody who doesn't have Buddhism as being barbaric, because they were essentially barbaric until Buddhism came in and it was a civilizing influence for them. But it's very important for us to relate to this material not as this is how things are, but as an invitation to become curious. Now, what generates struggle? This is moving, of course, into the second noble truth. What is the genesis for the struggle? What is the genesis for the suffering? And if you look in here, you'll see that I'm using the Gunther translation, three kinds of struggle, three kinds of misery. Gunther uses the term misery here for dukkha. Three kinds of suffering. And there are of conditioned existence of change and the suffering of suffering itself. What I want to do this evening is relate these three kinds of suffering to the three poisons, and also to some material that we worked with earlier, which are the three kinds of faith. You may recall in the chapter on relating to a spiritual teacher, there is faith which is rational appreciation, there's faith which was coming from longing, and there's faith which was that clear open quality. We could even say inspiration or what have you. Now, part of my reason here is when we get curious about where does the struggle come from, we inevitably come into contact with what in Buddhism are known as the three poisons. These are, in the Theravadan tradition, given these wonderful Victorian era translations of greed, hatred, and delusion. My preferred translation for these three now are attraction, aversion, and indifference. And I use these because these are what the three poisons are referring to are fundamental, very deep-seated reactions to experience. Now, later on, we'll study these from a different perspective, because, but I want to bring this in right at this point because it's highly relevant to this whole chapter. Attraction, aversion, and indifference are all dependent on something else. What might that be? Susan?
A self that does the that has the attraction, aversion, or indifference?
Yeah, basically. I was going to take it in two steps, but you just did two and one. One is there's a frame of reference, and what defines that frame of reference is a sense of self, which is attracted to some things, is averse to something, just doesn't care about other things. Now, I don't want to get into a detailed discussion of the formation of the sense of self. How many of you have some idea of what I'm talking about here, the sense of self that experiences attraction, aversion, and indifference? This is clear? Okay, so I don't need to go into it. You can relate to this experientially. Okay, now, I would actually say, I think it's fair that there are actually many different selves, and there are different parts of us, and some parts of us are attracted to one thing, and other parts of us are averse to the same thing. Anybody experience that in themselves? You know, these internal conflicts. So, in terms of these three forms of suffering, or struggle, or whatever, what's the problem with indifference? Art?
It causes you to ignore or not pay attention to what's going on. You just sort of look past it.
Right. And that's very much related to the suffering, the subtle suffering of conditioned existence. We just ignore the things. What's the problem with attraction? Kara?
Attachment.
Yeah, what's the problem with attachment?
I mean, I don't have like a single word, but you just get caught up in something and you lose
your ability. You fall in love. What's the problem with that?
Fall out of love.
Ah, the problem is change.
Exactly.
Yes, that's the second form of suffering. Okay. What's the problem with aversion? Anybody here experience of aversion?
In love.
What's the problem with aversion? You don't get to fall in love? Say a bit more.
Well, if you live your life in a bubble and you don't experience things, you don't experience change, then you know that kind of stasis is not going to contribute to your moving forward.
Okay.
Or growth.
Anybody else? What's the problem with aversion? Julia, I hear you chuckling in the background, so you've got something to say here.
It's unpleasant.
Yeah.
It's just downright unpleasant.
Okay. I'm going to suggest that that's primarily connected with the third form of suffering. It's just not much fun. There are a few people who enjoy being angry, but most people. You're looking at me. No, I.
I know one or two of them.
Yeah, but that's very often because they're ignoring very large parts of their experience. Yeah. So we can establish a certain correspondence between the three poisons and these three forms of suffering. In that, when things intrude upon our world in the way that we want our world to be, that's when we experience aversion, right? And like when I drop a brick on my foot, that's an intrusion. Or when something, and it hurts. And I have a reaction to that. And then when everything's going nice and it changes, then I experience a different form of suffering. That's the second one. And then there's just cruising through life, but it just doesn't feel quite right. That's the one most of us just ignore. And you can see people actively ignoring that. They don't question their lives. And we explored this to some extent in the workshop we did at the beginning of December. Many people just ignore the actual role of money in their life, and then they get caught up in all of that. So that's one way I wanted to look at it. The second way I wanted to explore a bit was in terms of these three forms of faith. Now, in a certain sense, these three forms of faith are could be regarded as antidotes to these three kinds of suffering or struggle. For instance, we feel aversion when there's the seeming intrusion into how things are, like something falls on my foot. But if we can accept how things actually are and come to an understanding of how things actually are, then we're less likely to feel aversion. In my business work, this comes up a lot because there's often a lot of aversion flying around in the corporate environment. And a large part of what I get paid for is telling people just how things are and helping them to see. I'll give you an example that comes up all the time. Somebody will come to me and say, I want a promotion. I've worked here for 10 years. I've done a lot of good work. I haven't received a promotion yet. And I feel I deserve one. And I'm really angry about this. You see, that's where the aversion comes in. And I look at them and say, well, it's got nothing to do with deserving. And they sort of look at me and say, what do you mean? I said, well, you've already been paid for that, so that's all in the past. Forget about it. You know, you can't use that as an argument for getting a promotion. They paid you for it. It's in the past. Why should they pay you for something that's in the past or give you more money for that? And there's, at this point, they're beginning to feel a little averse to me. I said, you're in a business environment. You've got to present an argument of why is it worth the business paying you more? That is, what can you contribute to the business by if they give you this permission, this promotion? How is that going to help the business? And they go, gee, you know, I never looked at it from that point of view. And they start thinking about that. Say, oh, there's lots of things I can, and they come up with a whole different argument. But now, because they see how things are, the aversion disappears and then becomes much more constructive. Now, so being able to see how things are, understanding things rationally, just seeing clearly, this is a very good antidote for the aversion. And that's kind of like that first kind of faith, understanding how things are, and the faith that comes from understanding just how things are. Now, the second one, you may recall, is the faith of longing, which comes, you know, there's a certain ideal, a certain picture that we have, and something we want to move forward towards. This is all about attraction. And there's two ways of relating to attraction. One is as a source of suffering. We're reaching for something, or things change and they aren't the way that we want them to be, and we feel pain for that. Or we can relate to attraction as a source of inspiration, a source of energy, and actually build on that and get curious and push more deeply into whatever's going on in our lives and how we can relate to them and turn that longing or that attraction into something constructive. And then the third one is this indifference. Now, as we've noted, this is about just ignoring how things are for us right now. And one of the things you can do, and I suggest you try this over the next week, when you find yourself in an ordinary situation, and let me give you some examples of ordinary situations where ignoring takes place a lot. The 10, 15 minutes you're in a movie theater before a movie starts. You know, there are people coming and going and things going on, and basically we're not paying any attention to any of that. Or waiting in line at a bank or a store or something like that. We're usually in a pretty dull state of that. We're usually thinking about something else. We're not in that situation. Those are the kinds of things, I mean, about very ordinary situations. Situations in which we're ordinarily bored. Okay? What I want you to try is, in those kinds of situations, open to what you're actually experiencing, everything, right there. So you're sitting in the movie theater, so you just sit there. And you hear all of the people talking. And you don't have to listen to the conversations, but just hear the sounds of all of those conversations. Because that's what's happening there. And maybe all of the activity. Now, they've made this a bit more difficult because they got into these weird slideshows, which are completely boring, etc. So you've got to include those. And you do the same thing when you're waiting in line at the bank or the post office or a store. Just open to that actual situation. What's that like? And you find, actually, that when you stop ignoring your experience, it strangely becomes much richer. There's a whole world there. And maybe it isn't as boring as we thought it was. There's all of this stuff going on. Any of you see a movie that came out in, I guess it was the late 80s, early 90s, 32 pieces on Glenn Gould? And it's a totally pretentious movie, but it's got some interesting bits to it. And in one of them, Glenn Gould comes into this truck stop. And there are all of these truckers, truck drivers, drinking coffee, eating donuts, all of this conversation's going on. And the way they present this, all he does is he just sits there and listens to the rhythm and the waves of the conversation and things like that. And just like, oh, there's a whole experience there. And so this is a way of not ignoring. It's actually opening to and appreciating just what's there in each moment. And it's a way of overcoming this indifference, which is a form of suffering. So that's something I'd like you to experiment with. Now, another thing I'd like you to do is look at how suffering or struggle arises in your own lives. What do you struggle with? And you might get curious about, why am I struggling with this? In the texts, you may recall, it says that it relates to, in terms of food, suffering is the subtle form of suffering is like unripe fruit, and the suffering of change is like poisoned food, poisoned rice, and the suffering of suffering is like mold on fruit. I think you have this nice thing, and it's rotten. Where I want to go around, do we have those ice cubes? Okay. I want to do something, an experiment with you. So we're going to hand out ice cubes to everybody. You'll have a paper towel to hold them in until we try this little experiment. Because what I want to do here is to distinguish between experience and our reaction to experience. So this is going to be a little painful, but it could be interesting. You can accuse me of torture later. Susan. Art.
So this is like probably the stupidest question on earth, but you were just talking about all pervasive suffering, suffering of change, mm-hmm. suffering of suffering. I don't get, like, what does that mean, all pervasive, and what does the suffering of suffering mean?
Well, these are terms. If we relate these to the three marks of existence, the suffering of suffering is the struggle just to stay alive. So it's struggling for survival. Okay? And that's what people are saying, you know, we have to do some work just to provide ourselves, and it's where we experience we have to do something to stay alive, and things intrude on our experience all the time. Then the suffering of change has to do with the second mark of existence, getting our emotional needs met. The reason that we experience change as suffering is, as we just discussed a few moments ago, it's because we become attached, or we want things to stay the way they are. And then they change, and now we suffer. And we struggle to get back what has changed, or to replace it in some way. That's why it's likened to poisoned rice. You know, you have the rice, but you just... Kenpo Jiaozhen points out, the food represents the body here. And so the body changes, and it doesn't stay the same, and things change in our world. And we're always trying to go back to that and hold on to, keep things constant in what we thought was a happier state. Yes, give me one too. Thank you. Okay, everybody got an ice cube? No, here you go. Pardon? Yeah. There you go. I think you've got one over there? Okay. I don't have one now, so.
Oh, here.
Okay. Susan needs one, too. Thank you. Now, you have the towel, so you don't get too wet in the process here. What I want you to do is to hold the ice cube in the palm of your hand. Just let it sit there. What do you experience? Okay. How cold is it getting? Okay. Anybody feel like it's so cold it hurts?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Okay. Well, now I want you to open to the actual sensations. I mean, when it's cold, it hurts. We want to get rid of it. We want to take the ice cube away from our hand, right? Okay. But now just open to the actual sensation, okay? Is it cold you're feeling, or what actually are you experiencing there? Is it a burning, or is it a cold, or is it something sharp?
Sharp.
Sharp, okay. So just experience sharpness. What other qualities does it have besides sharpness? The actual intense sensation, do you get wet in that? I don't get wet in it. Anybody else? I don't get numbness in the sharpness either. Okay, it's tingling, electric shock, what was you saying?
Throbbing.
Okay, so there's some throbbing. So there you are. Now, when you're experiencing it this way,
whatever, I don't care. Y'all have cold hands, I don't.
You scrunched up a piece, put it back in your hand, Kara. Okay. Now just open to that sensation of sharp, tingling, throbbing. And don't try to push it away, because that's the aversion. Now, when you're right in the experience, do you experience any aversion? Do you? So explore the feeling of pain, the sensation of pain. What is this pain? Randy? This is not an intellectual exercise. You have this experience, you're calling pain. So describe that experience to me.
It feels like it's burning.
Okay.
Like there's a flame on my hand.
But it's an ice cube. Okay, so it feels like burning. Can you experience the burning?
I think I am experiencing.
Yes, okay. So what if you just experience it? And you don't call it burning, you just experience it. What happens then?
There's still a wanting to pull away from it.
What wants to pull away from it?
My hand.
Does it? Anybody else? Okay. Let's take the ice cube out. Mine's almost gone. Anybody injured by this? No, it's really not that bad. Now, if we're thinking about the experience, then we have such notions of this hurts, I want it to stop, etc., etc. What if you just experience it? Lynette, Susan, could you pass?
I feel like it requires a willingness to just keep opening.
Because yes.
There's layer after layer, and you can sense the aversion, you know.
And what if you keep opening? What happens?
It's just experience.
Okay.
At the same time.
It's vivid experience, right?
It's vivid experience.
Yeah.
It presents a little confusion from me, at least.
Please.
I can keep opening and opening and opening. So if you cultivate the capacity to expand to everything, how do you know, or what part of a person then takes responsibility for recognizing when something needs to stop?
This is a whole nother question, and I agree it's a perfectly legitimate question. The purpose of this exercise wasn't to answer that question, but to try to point out the difference between pain, which is a sensation, and suffering or struggle, which is the reaction to the sensation. Okay, is this, you know, and I think actually having something physical like this, this is much better than using a Bunsen burner or a candle or something like that. Yeah. Kara.
I found when I had, when I was holding my hand, like when I'm holding it up and I'm, you know, like the struggle is, like what I felt was my hand getting really cold and it, my wrist tensing and then my arm tensing and then my shoulder tensing. And so there's all this like, you know, scrunching taking place with it.
That's all manifestation of aversion, right?
Right. It's all aversion. Absolutely. And, you know, whatever. It stopped. And then, but when I put it back in my hand and I set my hand on my leg and just
relaxed
and just let it go.
Yeah.
You know, it didn't feel good, but it wasn't.
It was quite tolerable.
Yeah.
And so you moved from reacting to just experiencing.
Well, I was trying to melt it with my mind. I'm not kidding.
But do you follow the distinction?
I totally do.
Okay. Yeah. Now, in a sense, this is what Buddhism's actually about. Nothing more than that. How to accept experience and just be with it. Yes.
It's like Fight Club where he kisses his hand.
I haven't seen the movie. I'll have to. Is it like Fight
Club?
Exactly
what it's like.
Okay. Linnea's question about how do you know, this takes us into a different realm completely. And just to respond to that question, because I don't want to go there in depth at this point because it takes us out of the subject matter of this chapter, is it's a matter of perceiving where the balance is. And when things are moving out of balance, then you know that harm is being done. And so then you move back into balance. Now, here there's no harm being done, so it's just a case of tolerating something, which most people wouldn't tolerate for very long at all. They go, oh, ow, oh, oh, and get rid of it very quickly. And that's a perfect example of reaction when just open to the experience. Then, okay, well, maybe isn't the greatest experience in the world, but that's all it is. I don't actually have to do anything about it. Now, translate that into your lives. How many incidents in a day do you react to that you don't actually have to do anything about? Give me a number between 1 and 1,000, Art. So that's something else that I'd like you to explore over the next week. Something arises. Do I actually have to do something about this, or can I just experience it? Now, this is going to run into all kinds of levels of conditioning in us. I want this, I don't want that, and we're back right in the attraction and aversion again. I want it to stay this way, that's the second kind of suffering, but it's not staying this way, and so forth. That's what I'd like you to explore. So, in the rest of this evening, I want to talk about the first two kinds of suffering a little more, a little bit more. And then next week, we'll talk about the third kind of suffering, because that's the one that takes us through the six realms. One way of thinking about the or understanding the first kind of suffering is it's the slight grating feeling you have when everything's going right in your life. The way that it arises frequently is a subtle sense of separation from the world or the world of experience. Everything's fine, but we don't feel quite there. Anybody know what I'm talking about? We're like one microsecond behind. Okay? We're one microsecond behind because we're interpreting experience, not just experiencing it. Now, how often have you experienced that? Does anybody have an idea of what I'm talking about here? Okay. How often have you experienced that? Explicitly. I mean, how many of you here recognize this? Okay. When you experience it, what do you usually do? This slight feeling of not being quite there. As I say, that slight grating feeling when everything's going right. Okay, yeah, Kara?
I was recently at Disneyland with someone who's I'm very close to, and it was a lovely day, and it was just really, really fun and enjoyable, but this person has a tendency to err on the side of, like, Eeyore-isms. And so we're going along and we're having a great time and we're sitting down and, you know, there are lots and lots and lots and lots of people walking by, and she looks at me and she goes, "One day the earth is just going to swallow us all," and I wouldn't let her finish. I was like, we're at Disneyland. The sun is shining. It's beautiful. I haven't been here since I was four. I'm wearing ears. You know, what do you want? Like... Yes, global warming exists, and so does Mickey Mouse.
Okay. So your point?
Is that I felt like it was one of those moments of disconnect, but mm-hmm. It's not necessarily that I wasn't thinking that the thought hadn't crossed my mind. But
okay, let's go back to just that thought crossing your mind. There you are, you're having a good time at Disneyland, and... Yeah, well, there's other stuff going on. What do you do with those thoughts?
I just don't get attached.
Yeah, you ignore them, right?
Yeah, I just let them go. I mean, I'm not going to shove them out of my head, because that's focusing on it. It, you know.
Okay. What I'm going to suggest here is that when that feeling comes up, most of the time we just ignore it. And that's what that... That's what Gampopa is referring to. Now, when don't you ignore it? Yeah.
You're saying with that, when that feeling of...
That slight feeling of disconnection. Uh-huh. Yeah. When don't you ignore it?
Well, no, just going back to the last one, you say we ignore it, and is that when we ignore it, that's part of the suffering because it's ignored?
That's the suffering that Gampopa's talking about, uh-huh. is that that's ignoring it.
Because I would actually think it's the opposite way, that you don't really ignore it, that you, it's present, and you kind of, well, in my own experience, is that I sometimes pay too much attention to it, and it kind of destroys the moment. Even though on the surface, you're experiencing the moment in a positive way, there's kind of that nagging feeling like it's temporary. Whatever that fun thing is going to end or something. And
here we're talking about two slightly different things, or actually two quite different things. And what you're talking about is the intrusion of other interpretations or ways of relating to your experience, which prevent you from just enjoying what's there. Mm-hmm. But what I'm talking about is a very subtle feeling of not being quite there, which most of the time it arises, we just ignore it. And my question now is, at what points when that feeling arises do we not ignore it? And I'm going to ask, why not?
Just sitting quietly.
Exactly. It can be a meditation, or it can be at some time you're sitting quite quietly, and there's this feeling of not being quite there. This is what Gampopa is referring to when he says, ordinary people, it's like a hair in the palm of the hand, and for the noble ones, it's like a hair in the eye. Now, when he's referring to ordinary people, it's the way that I would tend to read this is he's talking about when we're caught up in the ordinary way of experiencing things, just like you were at Disneyland. But when everything's quiet, then that vague feeling becomes a source. We actually experience it as a form of separation, of not being there. We experience it quite clearly, and we experience it as a form of suffering. And going back to what Julia said right at the beginning, that is usually, at some level, what drives or provides the impetus for spiritual practice. There's that slight sense of disconnection from the world. You follow? So I just want to bring that out as a way of connecting with that particular form of suffering. Julia.
Ken, in the way you've been discussing this, you're talking about a slight sense of separation, but I would argue that for some people they feel it very profoundly.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. Linnea? Where's the other mic? Okay.
I assume that you're implying this, but it seems like it's separation is not necessarily, well, it's from the world, but the world is, I feel like we're talking a lot about it as if the world's out here.
Yeah, it's a world of experience.
Okay.
Yeah. Quite right. We may experience it as a certain alienation or a certain separation. We may experience it as a question like, what am I doing here? Anybody have that question? No? I've been having that question a lot lately. Or it may come up as, what is the point to anything? Anybody have that question? Okay. Now, when those kinds of things come up, what do? We usually ignore them. We just go on with whatever we're doing. But we don't always ignore them. And then they think, wow. Yeah.
then it arises. And we realize that much of our life is a kind of struggle against those kinds of questions. That is what Gampopa is referring to when he's talking about this very subtle kind of suffering. It's actually, I've never really felt it was as subtle as they're talking about it does. Now, let's take a look at the second kind of suffering, suffering of change. The suffering of change arises from the experience of pleasure. Okay. Things are really nice. They're good. You're having a great time at Disneyland. And then your friend says, well, what about global warming? Okay? And you get irritated. Or you seem to, anyway. You don't have to say that. And so, it arises out of the experience of pleasure. Why? Because we try to hold on to the state of pleasure when things change. Can you do this? How many of you have tried to? Okay. Doesn't work. But and it's very much connected with wanting to get our emotional needs met, because we usually experience pleasure when we feel that that's happening, and then things change and we go, I want more of that, or I want it to stay. This very much, of course, connects with impermanence, because it is the nature of things to change. Yes, Carol.
But don't we suffer when we start to try to anticipate that change within the pleasure? Isn't that what creates the suffering? I find that's the middle ground. Like, you're feeling the pleasure, but then you are anticipating change instead of, and that's, like, the change is not so bad.
Well, there's already change. What leads you to anticipate the change? Well, you brought it up. I'm just asking. What leads you to anticipate change? I mean, the Eeyore mentality?
Yes. Past experience. History.
Okay. So, we cease to... here we are experiencing pleasure, fun, enjoyment, whatever you want. But we don't actually stay in the experience. We start thinking. And now things change. And just anticipating has already initiated the process of change.
Okay.
Okay? It's a change in itself. So, the way that you end the suffering of change is you experience things just as they are, moment to moment. There's a poet, I should have brought him this evening, a Japanese master called Ryokan. And there have been a couple of volumes of his poetry translated into English. My favorite one of the two or three that have been translated is One Robe, One Bowl. In some of his poems, he describes how he relates to each moment. So he's playing ball with the children and is just completely happy. And then evening comes, and he realizes he has spent the afternoon playing ball with the children and not begging for food. So he has nothing to eat. So he goes back to his cabin with nothing to eat. And he's totally sad about that. But that's his experience right there. And it's just so, you read his poems and they're just about what he's experiencing right there. And they're quite wonderful that way. So One Robe, One Ball is the name of the book. When I was in the three-year retreat, I had a great deal of illness and so a lot of physical and emotional pain from that. And someone sent me this volume in the middle of the retreat. It was very helpful to me because Ryokan describes himself, struggling with illness and struggling with loneliness in retreat. But he's able to relate to these experiences just for what they are. This is the way we end the suffering of change. And then the last form of suffering is termed, and we have this wonderful phrase, the suffering of suffering, or the struggle of the struggle, or however you want to do it. And in this, Gampopa goes through each of the realms. Now, I'd like you to read this material over between now and our class next week. These are very much presented as realms in which we are born. And this is what we experience in this realm, this is what we experience in this realm. What I'd like you to do is to read them as descriptions of particular emotional states and see how you can connect. So when you're going through the hot hells, for instance, you have the piercing hell in which you feel like your body has been impaled on a red-hot iron poker which runs right up the center of your body and it's just burning the body from the inside out. Does anybody experience anger that way? Okay. That's how I tend to experience anger, but other people, they experience anger as if a boulders or flaming boulders are crushing them from the outside. They're just tumbling down and they're getting crushed. That's how they experience anger. That's the crushing hell. So you go through these the hell realms, say, okay, where do I connect with this? And you find you'll probably connect with some of them and you may not connect with others. Then you have the cold hells. The cold hells aren't about anger, they're about hatred. Hatred makes you very rigid. And that's why it freezes you. And then reading about the pretas, the hungry ghosts, what it's like to experience the world from greed. And you can go through all of the realms that way. The emotions connected with each of the realms, just so it's very clear, it's anger / hatred for the hell realm, greed for the hungry ghost realm. The animal realm I usually translate as instinct, as doing things automatically. On January 13th, Julie is hosting the film night, and the film this time is Thank You for Smoking. There's two reasons. There's many things I like about this film. One is there's some really very, very clear depictions of various techniques of what I call mind killing, which is the way patterns work on us to prevent us from doing what we know we should be doing if we don't. But they're very well portrayed in this movie. And the second is, it's a wonderful portrayal in various points of the animal realm, where you're doing things just to survive. So, and that's why it's called instinct or automatic. Those usually termed stupidity. I don't think stupidity is a terribly good word in English for this, because it's really about doing things based on a very limited range of experience and ability. So you just do it automatically. That's why I use the term instinct. The human realm is about desire and how that manifests in one's life. Titan realm is jealousy. And the God realm is pride. And rather than reading these as I said, as realms that exist somewhere else, where in your own experience can you connect to that? For instance, is there anybody here who has a certain feeling of moral superiority?
Just by virtue of the fact that we're all here right now.
Okay. That's a form of God realm right there. And it'll be very interesting. Now, the other thing that I've asked you to do is to throw up some pictures and I on Facebook or videos that you think, because there's lots of stuff out there on the internet, and that'll be very interesting. It should be very entertaining. So I look forward to looking over those. Work with these in your meditation. Like, okay, read over the descriptions and then sit and go through your day. You might keep track, actually, of how many realms are you do you move through each day. Now, just do that for a couple of days. Just take an index card or a little notebook, and every time you change a realm, write it down. And just note which realm you moved to. Because it can be very interesting to see how you move from one realm to another. There's certain mechanisms which move you from one realm to another. That can be, we'll try to explore that a little bit too. So, and how much time, if any, do you spend not in a realm? And what is that like? These are the things I want you to explore. Okay? Should keep you off the streets for a while. Okay. Any questions before we close? Could you, someone ask? And Alex, the mic. Thank you.
So then, would you say then, Ken, that the extent to which we struggle or suffer in different forms, then if gradually we can see things more as they are, we would should then suffer less.
That's what I have found. The aim of Buddhism is to end suffering. We suffer because we cannot experience things as they are. So the more ability and skill and willingness, all three, we develop, then the more we'll experience things as they are. And what I have found is that when people are able to see how things actually are and accept them, then both body and mind relax. I've seen this over and over again. The suffering ends right there. They stop struggling against it. And often a very different avenue in their life opens up at that point. So I think it's a reasonable basis to say that when we can really experience things as we are, yes, then we stop suffering.
Process of practice would be then gradually working through or reducing a sort of mistaken conceptions.
I actually see there are three components to practice. One is to develop the willingness to experience things as they are, because a lot of times people just, I don't want it that way. And so that's one component. Second is to develop the skill, the know-how, to be able to experience things as they are. And that has a lot to do with what you were just naming, is being able to recognize mistaken conceptions and let them go. And the third component is building the actual ability to. sometimes we can be willing, we can know how, and we just can't do it because there isn't enough strength in our attention or what have you. So I don't think it's all reducible to one thing. I think we need all three of those components. Okay?
Thank you.
You're welcome. Okay. Any other questions? Randy, there's one right here.
About change. Okay, intellectually, we all know things change.
Yes.
We've never experienced any state of being in which change doesn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
Emotionally, we can understand that we don't want things to change. Okay, and say, yeah, that's a natural human desire.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, what I don't understand is the feeling that comes up so much is things shouldn't change. Is that somehow it's wrong that they do change. And where that came from, given that we've never actually experienced a state of non-change. Something about there's something wrong about the fact that things change.
There's a little demonstration that I learned from Charles Tart, who's up in the Bay Area. And I've done this a couple of times in groups. And you get a styrofoam cup. And what he does, he puts it on the floor. Everybody sits around. He says, okay, meditate on the styrofoam cup. So everybody sits there and meditates on the styrofoam cup. After 5 minutes, he gets up without any warning. He goes on the styrofoam cup. And everybody goes, what do you think the dominant emotion is in the room at that point?
He shouldn't have done that.
What's the dominant emotion?
Anger?
Sometimes it's anger. But the dominant emotion is loss. Okay? People feel they've lost something. And he points out, it takes less than 5 minutes to form an attachment to a styrofoam cup. Okay? This is where the notion that things shouldn't change comes from. Anything we put attention to, we form an attachment to. It doesn't take very long at all. And it doesn't matter what the object is, styrofoam cup. Much less someone that we're interested in and enthralled by, and you know, it forms very, very quickly. And then we don't want it to change. Now, this is why there's a term in Buddhism which has been very sometimes called outflows. It's like something goes out to us to the object. And it's an attempt to describe this phenomenon. It's something that our vitality is leaking out and being absorbed by the object. So the idea was to try to hold that back. That was one model to dry up the outflows. I think it was an old term for a form of awakening. But that, when you give that to people, that just leads to a bunch of suppression, so I don't find it a particularly helpful thing. But you ask, where does this idea come from? It comes because we become emotionally invested in any aspect of our experience to which we pay attention to for even a short period of time. Okay. And so to develop the freedom to accept change as it arises, that's a significant challenge. And part of that is being willing to experience the grief or the loss that comes with that. And grief is, to my mind, the term grief means the experience of the pain of separation or the pain of, or the change of pain. But now you just experience as a sensation, and the suffering comes because we react to that. We try to hold it constant or not experience that pain. But any time we're separated from something, there is pain. And we need to distinguish very clearly between the pain of separation and the suffering of change. Suffering of change is trying to deny or as a reaction to the pain of separation.
So the feeling of should is just a protective mechanism to try and avoid the suffering.
Yes, it's a counterproductive protective mechanism in myself because it is trying to impose an idea on the world rather than relate to things as they are. Okay. Let's close here. Can we do the dedication, Susan? Mm-hmm.